Welcome to the CFO Show. I'm your host, Melissa Howitson, CFO of Vena. As markets evolve at breakneck speed, finance teams need to balance fueling innovation and growth while simultaneously safeguarding the company's financial stability. This dynamic tension requires CFOs to be both visionary and vigilant. I'm thrilled to welcome Larry Roseman, CFO of Thumbtack, to the show. Larry is a seasoned finance executive with more than 25 years of global experience spanning finance, corporate development, investment banking, accounting, and audit. His career has taken him across industries, equipping him with a unique perspective on what it means to lead with agility. In this episode, we'll dive into the importance of how to stay resilient in the face of economic volatility and the evolving expectations of CFOs today. Larry, welcome to the CFO Show. It's great to have you here.
Oh, thanks, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can we start by having you give us a little bit of an overview about Thumbtack?
So Thumbtack is building the most trusted way for U.S. homeowners to hire the right pros for all of their home projects. And we partner with customers from the beginning of a project all the way to the end of a project to help them make decisions about that project with confidence. And, you know, our special sauce, if you will, is we do a really great job at matching you with the right pro for the right job that you need to do at that time. So for homeowners, what that means is peace of mind that the job will get done well and that we have their back if something goes wrong. And then on the pro side, we are delivering them committed customers, more intentful customers, which makes Thumbtack a platform that is basically the best investment for them to grow their business.
You have an interesting background. You have experience in investment banking, accounting, now as a CFO. How have some of these different experiences shaped what you think it takes to make a strong CFO?
At the foundation, to be a good CFO is to think about value creation. I think value creation at the end of the day is key. I certainly got that from my experience as an investment banker. But you know, beyond value creation, you know, at this point, I think technical skills, FP&A, accounting, et cetera, are just table stakes. And what really differentiates a great CFO today is someone that can influence, whether that's influencing and leading your team, influencing your peers on the leadership team, your CEO, or the board. Because at the end of the day, what companies need and what CEOs want is a strategic partner to the business.
I think about that's what makes it exciting to be in these positions in finance, because we really have this responsibility to help guide our organizations, you know, start to set the pace and see around the corners and take that strategic seat at the table. So totally agree with you there. And I think that's what makes it an exciting job to have. Others may disagree.
It makes it fun. Absolutely. Nobody wants to just crunch numbers. You want to be able to help drive value creation.
So what are some of the unique challenges that a company like Thumbtack would face?
You know, from a strategic perspective, you got to remember, we're not a goods marketplace selling things or e-commerce. And it's not a commodity like ride sharing or food delivery. Every job that gets done, every request that a consumer and homeowner has is effectively a unique SKU, to kind of borrow that SKU reference from like retail. But like any other marketplace, you know, you need both supply and demand to make it work. But for us, it's unique because it's like we're running 500 different marketplaces all over the country. We're in 500 different categories. And because it is so local, you need to make sure you have inventory, you have supply in each of those markets, right? So if we have a painter in New York, but we don't have that painter in Chicago, it doesn't do any good to that marketplace in Chicago. So that's kind of what makes it challenging from a strategic and financial perspective. And also, you got to remember, you know, it's unique in the sense that pros' time is perishable, right? If I'm a pro and I want to book a job at noon on Wednesday, if I don't book that job, that revenue opportunity is gone. And for the homeowner, there's really a high cost of failure, right? Oftentimes you're spending thousands of dollars on these projects and you don't want them to go wrong.
How do you manage to navigate through some of the fluctuations that happen while still trying to create some stability when it comes to continuing to operate a high growth company?
So we used to have just one, you know, capital allocation moment when we did annual planning. And we've shifted that now to, you know, more nimble quarterly investment cycles where we can roll forward this forecast for 6 quarters each time we do it, and then think about capital allocation on a quarterly basis. We also have done tighter integration between the finance team and the business by embedding finance people and analytics people directly into the business as opposed to just in a sort of FP&A silo. And then I also like to encourage decentralized decision-making as it relates to sort of, you know, capital allocation. So as the CFO, I like to think about how much money do I want to allocate for your envelope for this strategic initiative or this function? And then really empower you as the business leader to do the onesie twosie allocation between, is it this headcount or that headcount or this tool or that? Really look at like, what are we giving you to invest this year? And then you sort of make those, you know, empowered to make those decisions.
What I love about that, you know, all those ideas certainly resonate with me because they allow us to reassess where's the business at more timely. Are we still investing in the next most important things? And it's not like, oh, well, this is mine and I'm hanging on to these dollars for the next 12 months because you told me 12 months ago that this is what I could have.
Yeah, it kind of takes the air out of like this big moment, you know, in the year where all the money needs to get spent. And, you know, being flexible, being more nimble is key. And moving that to a quarterly cycle has proven to be.
Well, and the idea of the empowerment is great, too, because I think it helps sometimes in finance. What I've found is when we're trying to make those trade-offs, people come to us to say, I need, but not what would we not do instead? And by giving people that autonomy that, hey, here's the envelope, you decide where you want this to go, it helps to create that muscle gets better. But then even when you're sitting around the executive table where there are new initiatives that might need money being pulled from one place to another, people know how to show up in those conversations with, hey, here's a thing. I think it's an opportunity. Here's suggestions on where we might go and fund it so that we're not just the...
Exactly. And we've also pushed to, you know, when we think about capital allocation, to first think about reallocation of resources. And are they sort of devoted to the highest and best use at that time? So that's sort of the first bucket. And then if we feel like we've allocated it appropriately, then think about new dollars to put into the business.
This pivot that's happened over the last 3-4 years, where it used to be growth at all costs, and now it's a little more balanced. We still want to grow, but how do we do it profitably? How have you managed that pivot in your organization?
Do you need to invest to grow? And the best way to grow profitability is still to grow revenue, right? So the goal here is to establish the right margin structure for your business, right? The right customer acquisition, the right go-to-market motions. And then, so you have that right margin structure, and then be disciplined about growing your fixed costs. So you're growing your fixed costs at a slower rate than you're growing your revenue. You have a good margin structure so that you're throwing off good, you know, contribution margin, and then you see profitability grow in that way. The other thing that we've thought about here is taking a portfolio approach to capital allocation. So thinking about a portion of your investments that are intended to generate near-term profits, while having another portion of your portfolio that's dedicated to things that are a little more long-dated, right? So yeah, I think the keys here are you got to invest to grow, you got to have the right margin structure, you got to be disciplined about costs, and you got to think about a portfolio approach to generating near-term profits and ring-fencing things that are a little bit more long-dated.
And I love that. And my next question, which you're touching on that with this one, is, you know, how finance leaders can help maintain that financial stability but still making sure we are encouraging innovation, because it's easy for finance to be the squashers of innovation if it's just about fitting things in an envelope. And I actually think we have a responsibility to wear the innovation hat and be actually pushing our organizations to be more innovative. So any strategies that you found that work to do that?
Totally. And you know, we're a product and technology business. So I think it is even more key for product and technology led businesses to, you know, carve out a portion of R&D that doesn't have near-term revenue goals, right? So ring fencing some of these sort of zero to one things that are really looking for product market fit still, that are, you know, really game changers of innovation within the business. You don't want these engineers thinking about revenue, right? You want to give these folks milestone goals or testing and learning goals so they can prove and disprove hypotheses, because you're sort of investing in sort of the next big thing. So I think that's key, is to have a portion of your R&D portfolio that doesn't have short-term revenue goals.
And do you have any thoughts on how to do that for other parts of the business outside of R&D? Because sometimes I find teams will say, well, we're constrained, therefore we can't look at new ways of doing things or think about new systems. And I'm still trying to encourage even innovation within constraints, because you don't want to fall too far behind.
You have to incentivize the right behaviors. And, you know, I'm seeing that now in like rolling out AI tools, right? And sort of getting people to, you know, have goals to try these new things, which, you know, will have a big impact potentially on cost savings in the future or efficiency gains. But really bringing down those barriers for some of these sort of non-revenue generating or non-product type teams, to give them, you know, reward effectively, gold and sort of recognition for trying innovative things.
And when we think about volatile, uncertain times, as we try to be flexible with our business, to have a little bit of agility to react to what we're seeing, it can sometimes lead to this sense that we are thrashing the organization by every 3 months or 6 months saying, well, I know this is where we were headed, but we're going to pivot slightly this way or do this. How do you go about keeping that flexibility, but also maintaining a certain level of stability so people don't feel like, oh gosh, now it's a new thing today and the wind keeps changing, I can never get anything done?
Totally. Churn, right? That's what we call it. Well, I think the first thing is to explain the why, and to be transparent with your teams and really make them feel like they're part of the process, but actually be part of the process and sort of helping you understand the why and why we're sort of changing or moving things around. I think it's also about not just making sure teams have clear goals, but as a leader, being open to changing those goals throughout the year, revisiting them regularly, whether it's quarterly or every half, and really understand from the team, like, hey, this is what we need to change, and be open to sort of not moving the goalposts, but working with the team to change goals, but make sure that they're clear. And then lastly, I think it's about shared accountability. And, you know, if things change and you have shared accountability or shared goals, people understand that it's not just a zero-sum game, that you're all kind of rowing in the same direction, we're in this together. And that sort of makes it a little bit like, yeah, maybe what I wanted is sort of like harder to do, and it feels like I'm supporting what you want at this point in time, but we have shared accountability and shared goals, so it feels right.
And totally agree on, you know, the shared accountability, the why. And I think often the underpinnings of some of that is a level of trust that needs to be there. Hey, we're going to make this change, but you have to assume positive intention and trust that this person, then, if money is now being reallocated, they're going to accomplish what they needed to do. And if that's what's, you know, when I peel the layers of the onion, sometimes if that's where issues are coming, where people aren't quite able to get on board, trying to unpack that a little bit and just make sure that that culture exists. That
exactly. And it's hiring people that have a sort of company first mindset. And then as a leader, it's sort of exemplifying that, right? And always kind of going back to the question of like, in this decision, what's the biggest and best impact for the company? And then, like, if we all have that shared goal of doing what's right for the business, then it sort of becomes easier for people to kind of fall in line.
100%. Sometimes I even say, you know, especially in certain meetings, let's put on your company hat, not your department or individual hat, especially for this conversation. So now you've had lots of experience in implementing planning in high growth companies. What would be some of your top pieces of advice that you would give to others that are trying to mature the way they plan in a high growth environment?
Yeah, I think it's key to be open to change and being open to change processes. I think sometimes as finance people, finance teams, we get pretty religious around things like annual planning and process. And we feel very wed to making sure things were done like they were done last year. And pulling up every once in a while and figuring out like, hey, is this the right thing for the business at this stage and at this scale and at this moment? And if not, how can we be open to change? And it goes back to what we were talking about, communicating openly with your finance team as to the why we might want to change something, and then rewarding and encouraging people on your team to be flexible. And I find, you know, instilling that like growth mindset and really recognizing people that are trying to be business first, that are trying to be flexible and are sort of agents of change and really business partners to the business, those are the people you want to sort of promote and reward and encourage.
As you're implementing this kind of ongoing forecasting, how do you think about zero-based budgeting, or is there ever a time and place for it every so often? Because that often, I know, comes up periodically around executive tables. Hey, should we just start from the basics here and look at what this would look like fresh? What's been your experience there?
Yeah, we don't do that every year. When we have a big shift in strategy, that often correlates with the time when you might want to sort of revisit sort of a complete zero base or bottoms up sort of, you know, whiteboard of how we would allocate our resources. But I think if you're doing it if you're doing it often and you're doing it in a disciplined way, oftentimes I think that zero based approach can create, you know, more work and unnecessary work to end up in the right place. So I would do that sparingly, and I would probably try to do that really when you're having big strategic changes in the business.
And one last question for you. What advice would you give to CFOs about how they can build a team that is flexible and data-driven?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's imperative at this point to have as part of your team high caliber data science and data analytics people. This used to be kind of a nice to have or a luxury, and now I think it's a need to have. So to instill that data driven culture, having, you know, rock star data analytics and data science folks is key. I also think having like a data-driven like dashboard culture, like we are obsessed with metrics, and you know, we deep dive on these dashboards, you know, once a year or so, and really obsess over tweaking what goes into them. So, you know, you could take this data-driven thing too far, obviously, which you don't want to do. And you know, you don't want to end up in sort of analysis paralysis and overdo it and that sort of thing. And what I find is helpful there is like putting constraints on the resources of the people that are doing that. So as the business grows, you're not just adding another sort of data scientist or data analytics person. But yeah, I think the data science and data analytics folks have been increasingly more important to my team in terms of coming up with the right answers and just running the business.
Excellent. So much great advice that you've shared with us. Appreciate you, your insights, and certainly I learned a lot. Appreciate your time today. Now, whenever we have guests on, we do have some rapid fire questions we like to ask. So are you ready?
Great. I'm ready.
All right. First one, what do you think is the biggest challenge for CFOs to face over the next 12 months?
I think it's going to be testing and iterating on AI tools and figuring out how to budget for this without like immediate returns necessarily on our AI spend.
What do you think are the most important characteristics of a good leader?
Transparency, connection. So we share like our 360 reviews, lead by example, by being vulnerable and honest and explain to the team what we're working on. And then on connection, it's, you know, building trust, building empathy, and really creating a psychologically safe workplace, right, for people to have ideas and feel safe.
If you could recommend just one book that has had a significant impact on your career or your life, what book would that be?
A book I read a long time ago, it was called How Will You Measure Your Life by Clayton Christensen. Great book about really figuring out like what you should focus on, like fulfillment is more important than money and status, relationships are the key to long-term happiness, and yeah, staying true to like your values and having integrity. So I would check that one out.
I've read other books by him, but not that one. So definitely we'll put that one on the list. If you weren't in finance, what would you be doing?
My real dream is to be a pro tennis player, but because that is literally a pipe dream, I think I would be a high school tennis coach.
What is the most important skill for the future of finance?
I mean, I think it always will go back to value creation. So getting that sort of fundamental training early on, I think, is going to be key. But going forward, given where technology is going, I think being AI native and having a background in data analytics is going to be key.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Again, really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more on this topic, sign up for our free newsletter. You'll get a roundup of exclusive resources designed to help you grow your leadership skills and drive strategic transformation across your business. Visit thecfoshowpodcast.com to sign up now. For The CFO Show, I'm Melissa Howitson. Until next time.